Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and it's Tuesday, which means we've got MLS to discuss. Joining me to do so, I've got a man who necessitated an extra designated player spot in my heart. It's Joe Lowry. Hi, Joe.
Wow, Taylor, you've got DP spots in your heart. I think you should get that looked at. I'm not 100% sure. I think it's like cows who have all the different hearts, right? I don't know anatomy, but I think you should see a doctor.
I'm not sure if I appreciate the cow heart comparison, but you are correct that probably starting off by saying I have spots in my heart is not a great idea. It just means that I appreciate you, Joe. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, well, Taylor, I don't have extra DPs in my heart, but I do appreciate you nonetheless, and I want you to know that.
Very much appreciated. With us as well as a crafty veteran who deserves his own roster designation a la the Beckham rule or the potential Carlos Vela rule, it's David Goss. Hello, David.
It would be neither of those rules.
Well, that's my question. If we were going to have a David Goss rule,
the hummus
what
rule.
Would it be if you were given the opportunity? Is it just one random amateur gets to play every week?
Yeah, maybe. It would, but if it got created, it would be more like, see, people don't remember this, and this is what it would be. It would be like how when the Beckham rule was created as DPs, then they grandfathered Landon Donovan into a fake contract thing so the Galaxy could keep both of them. And no one remembers that there's a Landon Donovan rule because it doesn't matter. That would be my rule.
So
my rule would be the thing that no one knows exists.
Okay, yeah. Cool. I guess that's nice of you to say about yourself. Very nice, Goss. That feels on brand.
I'm interrupting this conversation to cover my tracks from earlier because I can already hear people typing in the Discord. I meant octopi. Octopi have multiple hearts and cows have multiple stomachs. That's where I was going with that. Mm-hmm. I felt like maybe everybody else on this panel knew that and I didn't. And so I looked it up and we're covered now.
Cows chew their cud. You got to have animals that chew their cud.
Shout out cows.
I'm going to move us swiftly away from this. shout out cows indeed, says Joe Lowry. We've got a lot of on-field stuff to discuss from this past weekend. But first, Joe, we've had some changes to the roster rules. They aren't groundbreaking necessarily, but they also aren't nothing. Can you take us through them?
Yes, and yes to all of that. So I'm going to set the foundation very, very quickly. MLS is a salary cap league. There is a soft limit on spending. It's a soft limit because there are ways teams can spend outside the cap on their players. You can go out and spend money on coaches and facilities, all that stuff. That obviously doesn't count towards the salary cap for your roster, but there are ways that teams can go above the cap, and the designated player rule is one of those rules. So you can spend any amount of money on a DP, and it hits your cap at a set amount. This year, that number is just about $680,000. The cap is about $5.5 million. There's also something called the U22 initiative, which Paul and Sam tried to brand Young Money and gave up on that clearly over time. The U22 initiative...
Sam specifically gave up on
it. Yeah, that checks out. You can spend...
It's because he has no spine.
Yeah, ooh, God said it. I didn't. You can spend any amount on a transfer fee for a U22 player, and you can spend a lot on their salary as well. They hit the cap at a set amount. It's between $150K and $200K, depending on age. MLS wants to try and keep this parity between the teams that want to spend, the teams that don't want to spend so much. So they make it a little difficult for you to have everything all at once. If you have three U22 players, you can't have all three senior DPs. You got to have either a young DP, which Atlanta United do, or you got to have somebody who's just sort of filling that DP spot for fun, not because you really think he's good enough to be a DP. Those are sort of the hoops that MLS makes teams jump through right now. A rule that is being discussed, as reported by Paul Tenorio, and reportedly trending towards happening. Like, I would be very surprised if these rules aren't coming into play by the summer window. The rule change is going to give teams a bit more flexibility for the top ends of their roster. So if these things are implemented and officially announced, teams could then have three designated players, any kind of DP that you want. And they could have three U22s. Or they could have two DPs and four U22 players, along with $2 million in general allocation money, which can help teams buy down players to fit them underneath the salary cap. So there's a lot going on here, but the general idea is that MLS is trying to give their teams a bit more flexibility at the top ends of their rosters, enabling teams to sign one more, like, really good game-changing level player as a DP, Or to go a little bit down the other direction that we might see a team like Philly go, or some teams that lean further into youth development, we could see them maybe shift down the second of those two pathways. So that's the sort of the high level view. Goss, I'm curious about your thoughts and how impactful you think this is going to be. And I'm also tired of talking.
I think it's better than it was before it came. There's more money in the league. There's going to be more spending. The way I internalized
that was
all
the lowest
of it,
praise I've ever heard. Thank you, Goss.
the way I internalized all of it was pretty much every team can add one player. Like, if you take everything that Joe just said, whether it's another designated player spot or an additional U22 spot while filling all your DP spots or the $2 million in allocation money, all of that really equals out for the most part for most teams right now to like one good player. Another starter, another high-end starter, another top five player, whatever it is, that's kind of how it equals out. And one of MLS's big problem is lack of depth. That's what you see in CONCACAF competition against Mexico. The rosters are not as deep. The high-end players are already good enough. The rosters aren't as deep. So that's helpful. I will say what I think most executives in Major League Soccer would say to you privately, which is that they don't want any of this. They just want to be able to spend openly inside the restrictions, which is they don't want to be able to spend like PSG and spend an endless amount of money. They just don't want the buckets. They don't want control over the way they spend. Mm-hmm. And I think then you would see teams built differently. You would have the Miamis who bring in Messi and then bring in Suarez and then have to spend lower on the bottom end of the roster because they don't have enough salary cap space. But then you'd also have teams that could put together nine really good starters or the best back line in the league. That's what most executives, when you talk to them off the record, will say, and that's what they would push for. This is more buckets. It's more control. It's two DPs, four U22s. Fine. U22s, it's not an endless amount of salary. Like, there's a pretty low cap actually on salary. It's an open end on transfer fee, but I think you can only pay the player like $650 or $750 or whatever. It hits the cap low. But there's a restriction to the quality of player you are going to get in that setup. The Thiago Amadas of the world are not signing for a contract like that. So, like, even though you've opened up the transfer fee portion for foreign clubs to be like, yeah, great, you haven't convinced those players to come. So even by adding U22 spots, you're still limiting the way you can improve your teams. It's better than it was because it's more money and it's more good players, but it continues down the road of, like, this is where we stand.
Goss, backing it up for a moment, from like a very basic beginner's perspective, why do we have all of these restrictions in the first place? Why are there so many rules and contract contingencies and all of those types of things when it comes to this league?
Do you want me to be Sam or Paul with this answer?
Sure.
I just need to figure out which what voice.
I think Sam.
What are we doing? The thing about Northwestern basketball and Major League Soccer is you've got this thing called the product committee. And in that, you have teams that want to spend more and want to spend less trying to work together. That is the basic situation. Is you're constantly, you have a league that's
really
constantly,
good Sam, by the way,
thanks. I actually was stoked about it. You constantly are trying to play that game of like what appeases, let's just be honest, the Vancouver Whitecaps or the Colorado Rapids versus what appeases Atlanta United and Inter Miami. And there's a lot of control because of the teams that started the league and are pretty central to helping build a lot of that. And there's also control in what the league is trying to accomplish. Like, the Beckham rule was created not to make the soccer better, but to bring in stars to market. Not that it doesn't make the soccer better, but like, it wasn't created in a way that's like, this is how the soccer is played and how can we get to the next step? You are constantly working within those rules of like what you're trying to accomplish. Are you trying to become a selling league? Then you're going to put a restriction on teams so that they buy these young players that would then be sold, rather than saying you get four more players outside of cap with unlimited transfer ability. Because if you do that, a lot of GMs and coaches who want to win games, they're going to go get a 28-year-old from the Argentine League, or they're going to go get a 27-year-old D-mid from the Brazilian League, like a João Paulo. Those players are not sellable. So if MLS wants to enter the world market in that way, they then put a restriction on the teams and say, yeah, you could go spend money, but it has to be on players in this bucket that then accomplish this goal of us becoming a selling league and enter the world market in this way. So you have push-pull between the different owners. You've got control coming out of the league. And this is how you end up in this system where It's probably a little, it would be impossible, as Paul mentions in his article about this, like, it's odd that it comes midseason. It would be impossible to break it all down today. Like, you're in the middle of a season. So it then would have to, if you move towards that, it would have to be a process. But we continue to entrench deeper and deeper into it.
I want to get into the new rules, the changes, in just a second. I want to drill down a little bit more on this. Who would you all say is the best GM? I've asked this before. I'm asking it again. Who would you say is the best GM at navigating the intricacies of MLS roster rules, or who are some of them?
Yeah, Garth Lagerwey is the one that comes to mind first and foremost with a lot of this stuff. I think Chris Albright's done a great job in Cincinnati. I think John Thornton's done a great job in LA. There are several others that belong in that kind of conversation, but those are just a few.
Do you feel like those GMs for those teams are the type that would be okay with just completely loosening things and having it be spend what you want or spend what you want within reason? Or do you feel like because they have that competitive advantage in knowing how to navigate these things, they are less likely to support those things? I know I'm asking you all to sort of tell me the philosophy of individuals. You might not be able to do that, but I think you can see what I'm asking.
I guess I'm obviously not sure. I think there would be a little bit of sorrow in a weird kind of twisted way that would happen when some of these obscure rules go out the door, because it is a competitive advantage for the ones who understand the league and have used those things to their benefit. At the same time, I think if you're a smart enough CSO, if you're a smart enough general manager, you would probably back yourself to be able to create a competitive advantage in almost any environment. So I guess, like, yes and no, if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I mean, here's just a tiny example. Chris Albright takes over Cincinnati. They've got the top spot in the allocation order. He used it to make like $450,000 in allocation money on players he was never going to sign by trading out of that spot. That's now gone away. But he has still done a good job running that team, finding deals where he can. So I think to Joe's point of like, he's good at what he does. His group is good at what they do. I think him, I would add Tim Bezbachenko and the Columbus front office to the group that Joe mentioned. They would all believe that like their process, their scouting, their recruitment, the way they get players in and make them comfortable, like they would believe that they could still win. You would probably look more to teams that are in the middle spending maybe and say, how would they want to handle it? But I think for the most part, most of those people would say, yeah, like, let us do whatever we want.
Yeah. And I guess to take us back to the rule changes, because I didn't get through the full list. The other two things very quickly, there's a buyout rule that's coming where MLS will increase the number of contract buyouts that teams can use. Right now it's one. This time it would be two per season per team. I think that is another no-brainer way to help teams that are willing to spend a little bit of money. And in conclusion, Emmanuel Rigoni, bye-bye. Up next, there's extra general allocation money that's going to be tossed out potentially on outgoing transfers. Right now, you can convert $1.2 million of an outgoing transfer fee into general allocation money, which you can use to basically help supplement your roster and find better players and fit them under your cap. In certain situations, you'd be able to hit more than that going forward. So at least over a set number of transfers, over a set period of time, that is the rule that I think is probably the least consequential of all of these. I'll toss out my two cents generally on these rules. It's progress. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that this will make MLS better. Not in the way, though, that the casual viewer is going to notice, which is the big hurdle, by the way, moving forward for Major League Soccer. If they come out of the Messi era and they haven't moved forward in a meaningful way that I think, like, some general soccer fan who knows the game and understands what it looks like when it's played at a high level, if they don't move the needle closer to the point where that person's going to sit down and say, hey, this isn't too bad as far as the soccer is concerned, I feel like this is all a little bit of a waste. But that's not happening with this rule. But it is a step forward. Like, this is an encouraging sign given how it felt like over the offseason nothing was going to happen, because it didn't happen before the season got started. It is stupid to me that this is happening ahead of the summer window when teams have already planned their rosters and weren't planning for this. I honestly do not understand why this is happening now and why it didn't happen 5 months ago. Like, I have yet to hear an explanation that makes any sense to me whatsoever, but it's here now, or it's about to be here now. I do think it makes MLS better. I think these are generally good rule changes within the structures that already exist. I think it will let teams, like Goss said, add basically one more really, really talented player. And Miami is a good example of this, just because they're the team that sort of everybody seems to know. And obviously, let's not kid ourselves, the team that's driving these rule changes in the first place, which I think is fine. If I'm a fan of another MLS team...
I mean, isn't that like...
No, it's not the answer to the timing question, because like Miami was here 5 months ago. Like, I don't know. Fair. This nothing has really changed for Inter Miami roster-wise, at least in terms of like their need to demand more stuff now versus 5 months ago. Everybody knew the moment you opened up the floodgates, they're going to be the one taking advantage of it.
Also, if it was a rule created for Miami, it would have been done because Gregory would be on the team.
Like, yeah,
they would have saved themselves that was stuck trouble. With too many DPs.
So like I said, I just don't understand why this is happening now. Miami are a good example for the kind of impact this can have on a roster. So I think about them right now. They have three U22 slots filled. So they've got all those spots filled between Aviles, Diego Gomez, and Redondo. So they cannot have three senior DPs. I know people are chuckling right now because it feels like maybe there's some accounting weirdness going on or a lot of pay cuts. What we know is that it's the latter, but who knows, right? So right now, they can't have three
Jordi
full
Alba
DPs.
Owned that island, Joe. Yeah, nobody bought him that
island.
He's got a good
island.
He already owned it.
He's got a great island.
Don't ask questions.
So they've got Messi and Sergio Busquets as their two designated players right now. And weirdly enough, it is Leo Campagna who's occupying that third DP spot. He's one of those, like, Walmart brand flavors of designated player. He's not a full senior DP. With this new rule change, they can put somebody else in that spot. Like they can go out there and find somebody else to go out and occupy that spot. Like there are opportunities here for them to get a little creative with all this stuff. They can buy them down. They can add another U22 player. Like it just gives them more flexibility along the way. And there are other teams obviously that would take advantage as well. But Miami's at the center of a lot of these discussions for obvious reasons.
Can I just throw in one of the things that Joe mentioned as we were going through is the buyout, I think, is very big because with the calendar for MLS, it's really hard sometimes to get out of contracts because you're off windows with a lot of teams from other leagues. And like the only way to get out of contracts with these players is to send them to another league. No one in Major League Soccer is going to take on. Joe mentioned Emilio Rigoni, but like there are other players who aren't even DPs, they're just on TAM contracts or, you know, above the minimum or above the threshold, whatever, where it's like you need to get off that deal. And MLS teams get stuck on a lot of those players because our season ends, the windows overseas haven't opened yet. Then they open, but we're in preseason and no one wants this player who hasn't played in 3 months. Then they come back for the season. Then the summer hits and the MLS team can't account for like how they're going to get rid of them and how they're going to deal with them. And it gets stuck. So I think that is a big one in terms of adding players. And that might mean adding a second good player, because if you can get off a contract and then refill that money, that might be really big for you. But it's one of those things where, like, in terms of why it's happening now, I think San Jose, if they knew they would have an extra DP spot down there in this season, they may have given Vela the spot. Or LAFC may have given Vela the spot. Like, it would have been less precious over the course of this offseason for some teams to use that spot, knowing they'd have, for LAFC, they'd still have two additional ones to use on a Giroud and someone else this summer. For San Jose, it wouldn't have been, do you want to use your last spot on Carlos Vela, where you don't know his fitness, you don't know where his mind's at, you don't know his body. It's less of a risk if you have more spots to have used it. So I think it could have helped a couple of these teams in the offseason. It will still help all these teams in the summer because they've got money now and they're going to go spend it.
Shockingly, I am very much enjoying the rules conversation. So let's take a break. Let's come back. I have a few more questions for you both, and then we can look at the weekend that was. Back soon.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. So to reset where we were, I believe the previous deal was that you could have three senior DPs that allowed you to have one U22 player. The new rule would be you can have three DPs and up to three U22 players. David Gossett, give me the thumbs up. Is that correct, David?
If you have three full designated players, which means it doesn't have to be a young DP, doesn't have to be a low-end one, like an Alex Ring or a Darlington Nagby that can be bought down, it doesn't matter anymore. You can have three U22s. If you only have two, then you can have four U22s, and there's an additional GAM that's added to your roster if you are set up in that scenario.
So my question then becomes, the way I saw a lot of this covered was with caveats about U22 players aren't always the most reliable. They're not always going to hit right away. You're never sure if you're fully going to get the finished product. Here is my next question about these roster changes. So the way I saw it sort of covered with a few little caveats was that the U22 players that you can sign aren't always guaranteed to be the same as a designated player. They're not guaranteed to hit right away. They're not guaranteed to give you return on investment. They're a little bit more of a gamble. Joe, would you agree with that sort of summary of the U22 player? Like, are there more proven entities that have made sense, or do you feel like it is a little bit of a roll of the dice?
It's a real roll of the dice. Not that you can't put yourself in a better position to get the role that you want. Like, you might be able to weight these dice a little bit when you go out there and go through a nice scouting process and look at the numbers and go through all that stuff. But when you buy young players, you are paying for potential. Like, that is a lot of how this works. And I think among the smart GMs and chief soccer officers around Major League Soccer, there's an acknowledgement of that. There's a thought of maybe, hey, like, maybe we use some of these spots on our own homegrown kids and we lock them down for a little bit and you sort of go from there instead of always going abroad. Not that you can't find value. Like obviously you can. Into Miami have found some very talented players to fill their U22 spots. They have a boost because they have the pull of Messi that no other team in MLS has. But you can go around and look, and there's some nice options in Portland. Like, there have been good uses of this rule. But I think as it relates to the change, which would let you have either go down harder in the DP lane or harder in the U22 lane, I think the teams that are most ambitious when it comes to their spending will go down the designated player route and take advantage of that newfound flexibility while still supplementing the roster with U22s. But I think it's very, very clear that that is where the most win-now value is in Major League Soccer.
I agree with what Joe said. To me, and I've been one of the ones probably that came up in some of you processing this, Taylor, yelling about this, you cannot build rosters and rely on under 22 signings in Major League Soccer because of, like I talked about, with the cap on the salary you can give them and obviously the cap on their age, they are often unreliable players to be consistent. But you are protecting teams from that issue by allowing them to fill in experienced players around them. So the reason that U22 initiative was created was to take them out of DP spots. Like, teams were getting stuck in situations before the U22 initiative existed, saying, like, if we want to get a high-level young player and we want to sell them, we have to use a DP spot. And in doing that, those players were struggling because they didn't have good players to lean on. So here's one example is Dylan Barrero. Like, Dylan Barrero is phenomenal for Revs when he's healthy, which has been never, but that's fine. But part of the reason Dylan Barrero is so good is because Carlos Heel's on the roster. He's not the 10. He's not the sole focus. He doesn't have to be the whole team. But then you look at like a Martin Ojeda, who struggled last year at Orlando, where Facundo Torres is also a young playmaker and it leans on both of them, or what Santi Rodriguez has become at NYCFC. That's really hard. So I do think in these rules, you've set up a situation where it's either more of a mass quantity of like, okay, of four, maybe two will hit. So you've got more risk, or you can now have three full DPs where it's like, now you can have three experienced players who can carry the load, can be your spine, whatever it is. To me, Santi Moreno is like one of the best U22 signings in MLS history. Has always played in a team that has a Diego Chara, that has at times a DP center forward, a Valeri, a Nivander, whatever it is. And I think that's been a large part of his success, is like he's been able to be a part of it and not the center focus of it. And I think it's impossible right now with the way the rule's set up to build a team around it. So you've created these buckets to sort of protect teams by saying, like, you can take that risk and it doesn't guarantee that you're going to struggle with results, because you can also spend on experienced pieces that can help carry the team forward week in and week out.
So more buckets, more regulations, more protections, basically.
Let's just go to the Tupperware store. Let's get a zillion. Let's put a name on all of them, and every roster spot Perfect. Gets to be a different bucket.
I like that. We've now entered the phase of the show that's called Make MLS Make Sense to Taylor. Joe, we talk about buying down designated players. Can you buy out a designated player? I do not know the answer to that.
Yep, okay. you can buy out. So right now, teams have one buyout. Under the new rules, they'll have two. You can basically pay out their deal, and they go away, and you now have a new DP spot open on your roster, and you can go out there and make stuff happen with that roster spot.
Has that happened? Has a DP been bought out? Like, I don't know what happened to Rodolfo Pizarro. I know he was around and no longer is, but...
I think Toronto bought Josie out.
Okay. There we go. All right. That's a good one. And then when you sell a player, as you said, the existing rule is what? You can put $1.2 million? Is that what it is?
You can convert $1.2 million of that into allocation, in general allocation money, which helps you go out and sort of fit players underneath the soft cap.
So when Chicago sold Slonina for $10 million or whatever it was, they can convert 1.2 of that into GAM.
Right.
What happens to the rest?
The MLS takes a little bit of a chunk of that, and the rest they can reinvest into other parts of the club. Okay. Like the example that Goss brought up, I think, on a recent show is with the Ricardo Pepi sale, right? Where Pepi goes over to Augsburg, which went awesome. Just, you know, so good. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they're sitting on a fat chunk of cash, and they can reinvest some of that into their roster. But, you know, maybe not a coincidence that they go out and drop $7 million on Alan Velasco from Argentina, which was a club record transfer fee. So clubs are getting their hands on chunks of that money.
And the other stuff, Taylor, is like training grounds, scouting net. Like, that's spending money outside of their roster.
So they still have it. MLS takes that little cut, as you said, Joe, but then they can use it elsewhere. And the gist would be that with this rule change, if you are Dallas or Chicago or the Revs with their goalkeepers, if you're making that one big sale every year or every other year, it allows you to just spend more of that on your actual roster to make you better for selling that one player, instead of sort of punishing you, as opposed to another club that maybe sells three players for $4 million or something like that.
Sure.
They're getting more money to put in. Got it. Yeah. Cool. Okay. That makes sense. Final question that could make things even murkier is just an opinion for both of you. The other one that I saw some ink spilled about would be the proposed, but certainly not ratified at present, Carlos Vela rule is what it was being dubbed, which is basically a proposal that will maybe end up getting voted on in the winter meetings that would allow clubs, here we go, to re-sign a veteran player aged 33 or older who has played for that team for 4 years or more to a new deal up to $1 million above the max budget charge. We're already getting into the weeds. So they would just have a cap hit of $200,000, which is the same as many U22 players. So that would basically allow teams to keep hold of veterans who don't quite meet that DP threshold or can't quite play at that level, but you don't want to get rid of. And so Carlos Vela is the obvious example here. I think Nico Lodero was another one I saw mentioned, and Demir Krylock as well. Goss, how do you feel about that proposed move?
So in saying all of this, like, here are the rules, here's how it works. Like, I'm a huge NBA fan. So I'm like constantly reading about bird rights and double aprons and all this stuff. I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that sports fans can like understand this stuff. So I don't think all of it has to go away. I was saying from the beginning, like what executives would say, I think. Mm-hmm. I like this rule because I want there to be club legends and I want there to be established faces that people know and love. And I love the idea of like Carlos Vela helps bring the next generation through and finds that role. It is one of the things that still exists in Major League Soccer. It's really hard to find the right pieces that are going to come in and like understand the project. So it's really hard to go out of Major League Soccer and find the right guys that are like, oh yeah, I want to travel around a full continent in the summer, play on all these different surfaces, be committed to this project, go and play my heart out like at Colorado in front of 1,000 fans, or not vape on the plane. Whatever it is you're looking for, like, it's not that easy. And so I think being able to help keep a player that is already committed to the project and is already influential and already a big name in your team without saying to squads like, yeah, that's one of your three best players, I think is crucial. So I like the idea of this rule, and I think it fits into a space of like the way NBA operates of like first contracts and second contracts and third, and NFL, I think, is in a similar spot. I have zero idea about baseball, so I wouldn't even go there. You are talking to American sports fans more than soccer fans there, which is part of the issue that MLS always has. But I think it's fine, and I like the idea of like how it helps build rosters because I like the idea of building club legends.
Yeah, I think there's some marginal benefit from like a narrative benefit that comes from having Carlos Vela stick around in LA, which I do imagine is going to happen regardless of whether this rule is implemented, which it won't be for this year, as you said, Taylor. I think there's some marginal benefit narratively to have Demir Krylak sticking around at RSL, and maybe that sells a few more tickets. And so I think generally that's
Valeria
a good idea.
In Portland.
Yeah, yeah. There are good examples. I don't care about any of that. I'm not a particularly sentimental person. That doesn't really move the needle for me. What I will say is just from a roster building standpoint, this is another way to potentially get a good player, someone who is capable of contributing at a level higher than what they're counting against the cap. So if it's, what was the number, Taylor? $200,000 that these players would count against the cap? I don't remember what you said. But You go through and look at the MLSPA salary list from last year. There aren't a lot of like good to slightly even less good MLS players making less than $200,000. If you can get Carlos Vela, even at his age now, even though he's not able to contribute at a full level, if your ownership is willing to pay him, you know, whatever that number is, a million above the max salary budget charge, which would be like you could pay him almost up to $1.7 million a year. Like, if your ownership's willing to do that, great. Like, we need more. As far as I'm concerned, we need more MLS teams that are willing to commit resources to their roster. And it's helpful when MLS tosses out a rule like this, where if you can go out and Seattle can keep Nico Ladero as their, you know, rotation option, 1,200 minutes in the regular season, 1,500 minutes in the regular season, number 10, and have him only count for, you know, $200,000 against the salary cap. Like, absolutely. I think it's a good idea that gives teams more, it gives them more ability to build better rosters. Like, that's the thing I care about. I understand that's the sentimental angle that like really does play well here. But I think just from the dollars and cents standpoint, in terms of building the best possible squad you can, this helps ambitious, granted, but this does help ambitious ownership groups and teams go out and build better teams.
Last little piece that I'd add, more sentimental than Joe, because I have a beating heart and Joe's got cow spots right. And whatever he's right. got, and six of them, but also three stomachs, is...
We did also, Goss, to your point, we did have to add the no vaping rule for Joe on the TSS contract.
Yeah, of course.
Just which I'm still doing, by the way.
Yeah. It just smells like strawberry smoke all right. the time in this Zencaster room.
People can't see. Joe is just a cloud of smoke with a microphone. That's all we can see right now.
Yeah, I've actually never seen his face. part of the pitch to some of these players, Hugo Lloris is probably a bad example. Vela's a better one, but in a different space, is like, come here and like live here. Like, retire and live in this city. And, yeah. like, that's a big part of, for the back end players are like, yeah, I want my kids to be born in the U.S. I want to live in America. I want to get a passport or a green card. Maybe I want to coach and be part of her front office. Like, there's all these great things that can happen. And so I think this is actually a benefit to players as well. Like,
agreed.
Bringing more money into the salary cap is always a good thing. But, like, these are players, and some of them won't really need it because they've made millions in their career. But, like, this is a reward to a player that wants it and that has earned it. And so on top of all the sentimental stuff, like, I think it makes it an easier pitch to an Olivier Giroud. Now he's maybe a little bit too old already, where it's like, come here at this age and then play these years. We'll re-sign you and you'll retire here and your kids will grow up here and your family will move here and like all this type of stuff. That's a big conversation with players in that pool, like a Lodero when he first came to the league and then tried to keep him and stay and all that type of stuff. And I think it's one that's worthwhile for MLS to keep in the conversation, even as it tries to get younger and, you know, change roster setups and stuff like that.
I was about to propose a new rule and get your thoughts on it, but then I realized it treads maybe a little too closely to a dystopian future Black Mirror nightmare. So instead, I feel like that's a good point to end this rules chat on. Let's take one more break. We'll come back. We'll talk about some of the things that happened this weekend and didn't happen this weekend. Back soon. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode. Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. Joe, let's talk MLS, not yet on the field, because I want to talk about Emmanuel Reynoso for a moment. My looming question, still a weird situation.
Looming question.
I see what you did there.
Reports came out from a presser that CSO Khalid El Ahmad had in Minnesota. The quote is, Emmanuel Reynoso did not attend his recent green card appointment. He remains in Argentina. We do not have an updated timeline for his return and have no additional comment at this time. My overall takeaway on all this is not the first time Emmanuel Reynoso has not shown up. It's the third time, at least. It's time to move on. Like, I believe that very, very strongly. We're talking about buyouts. Maybe this is another candidate for a buyout. I don't think that's probably where it's heading, because he does have real value as a player. But this is huge. This is a season-altering situation for Minnesota United. It's feeling more and more unlikely that Emmanuel Reynoso will come back and be integrated into this team, because he's barely played this season after not showing up on time yet again. He's back in Argentina. Clearly, there are major personal issues that he has to work on down in Argentina that are distracting him or making it so that it's not worth it for him to come back and actually fulfill his contract with Minnesota. But like, Emmanuel Reynoso is one of the absolute best players in Major League Soccer. He's one of the best number 10s. Number 10s are very, very important for a lot of teams that don't have super well-rounded squads, and Minnesota United are one of those teams. They've had good results so far this season, even with all the turmoil, but losing a player of Emmanuel Reynoso's caliber, and it does feel like they're going to lose him, takes them from being a team that can probably pull off a playoff upset or two to a team that I'm not sure can anymore, even with a little bit of a more diverse tactical approach from Eric Ramsey. So this is massive. Like, this is absolutely huge. And I think the reason why it's not being discussed a ton, there's a couple of them. This has happened before, and Reynoso sort of always seems to find his way back. But this is new under new leadership. The other reason, we're just not really sure what's going to happen here. Maybe he does end up coming back. I'm skeptical. But this is a season-altering situation for Minnesota United, and it's one that I think takes a lot of the shine off that team in 2024.
The new leadership is why it feels different, because you are now in a situation where, one, it's not your guy. Like, Adrian Heath spent over a year trying to get Emmanuel Reynoso to come to Minnesota and build his team around him. If you're Eric Ramsey or El Ahmad, you're like, What am I doing? Why would I leave this unknown in my situation? And I think that's where it feels different. It also feels different because Minnesota's been good. So, like, in the past, it's been when Reynoso disappears, well, when Reynoso gets back, then maybe it'll work. Now you've got a model to be like, do we really need this guy? And it seems like committed to a playing style that he doesn't even fit. So the convo since Eric Ramsey's been hired is like, how will he and Reynoso mesh? Reynoso doesn't work very hard. He doesn't move a ton. Ramsey wants the high press and play more direct. This is like all of the solutions. The only big problem here is that Reynoso has tanked his transfer value. And like, you have to go to your owner and say like, yeah, we had some good years, but like, we're going to take a bath on that transfer fee. Which is a one-off for Minnesota in that it was a one-off that they got a talent at this level, and it was a one-off that they spent the money to get him.
Right.
But the reason he was available to Minnesota was because other teams were worried about stuff like this.
Well, it's not, though. It's not like taking a bath on the transfer is the only problem, though, Gus. And you kind of said it, because Reynoso is a ridiculous talent. Like, he is so incredibly good. Like, do we think Minnesota United can go out and find another DP, like, reasonably, who's as good as Emmanuel Reynoso? I certainly don't think so.
But if they find one that fits their style better and comes and plays,
yeah,
are they not better off than just like the diamond that falls from the sky that is Reynoso?
Yeah, I think you're better off over a season. I don't think your ceiling's as high. Like, when it comes down to, like, Minnesota United aren't going to be competing for the Shield. That's not in their cards for them with their current roster construction, in my view. It's certainly not in the cards for them this season. I don't really think that's what they build for as a club. We haven't seen them spend at the level that makes me think that that's possible for them. They're building towards making a playoff run. And I think when you take Emmanuel Reynoso out of this team, assuming, and I understand you do have to assume that he's going to be around for the playoffs, but assuming he's going to be around for the playoffs, I would rather have Emmanuel Reynoso in my team than basically anybody else I can reasonably imagine filling in that spot. I think Minnesota are overperforming a bit so far this season. I don't know. I mean, and they're not even performing at that high of a level when it comes to their results. They're sitting on 11 points right now through seven games. That's fine. It's good enough in MLS, which is a low bar, but that's where we are. I think this is a little bit of a bigger deal as it relates to the talent and the future of this team. But I also take your point, David, that if you get someone who can actually give you 2,500 minutes a season and perform at a, I don't know, top third DP level in Major League Soccer, you're probably in a mostly okay spot.
A couple big stories from the weekend. Let's start with Miami's win in Kansas City at Arrowhead Stadium. It was a rowdy atmosphere at the same time. It was like 72,000 or more. I get why they have to do that, or why they do that when it comes to Messi coming to town, why you might want to have that additional capacity and maybe a little bit more revenue. At the same time, I do feel like maybe it hurts your home field advantage to some extent. Goss, do you have thoughts on MLS teams accommodating Messi or accommodating crowds by moving to NFL stadiums?
Yeah, my big thought is less competitive. The home field advantage thing is probably true, but I don't know. Joe has said a million times, 500 teams make the playoffs, like, get over it, win a game at home. You didn't have to travel. But my big concern with this whole thing is like, everyone who showed up to Arrowhead, what did you sell them? What experience did you sell them for the future? And I think you sold them an NFL experience. An NFL stadium, same concessions you come to 8 to 10 times a year for Chiefs games, same physical layout, same setup, same fan experience. And I think MLS's number one selling point is the in-stadium experience. I think the stadiums are built really well. I think the supporter sections are unique to American and Canadian sports. I actually think they're unique globally as well. And it's a different, for the most part, there are stadiums that are in different locations, so they're convenient or inconvenient for other people in the city or metro area, and they are their own experience. Like, to me, that's MLS. If I can get you in an MLS building, I think I can get you back. That's my feeling. So, like, people who live in Nashville who don't like soccer, if I can get them to Geodis Park, I think they're going to come back because it's not like a Titans game, and it's not like a University of Tennessee game, and it's not like an NHL game. So when you now take the one thing that everyone wants to come to and you take it out of your atmosphere and out of your unique perspective and you put it into the other thing that everyone already goes to and sells tickets for.
Yeah.
What have you accomplished?
I hear what you're saying, and I think there's truth to that. Is it not that these people wouldn't have shown up to an SKC game regardless? Or maybe this is largely fans who do come to games anyway and they already know the SKC experience? I don't know. Are you not tapping into, hopefully, a different pool of people that you wouldn't have access to before?
Maybe, but you're tapping into them in a space that's not the thing you're trying to sell them.
Yeah.
So, no, like, my point is when Messi came to Red Bull Arena and didn't play, most people in that building don't go to Red Bull games. And I have talked to people who are like, oh, the commute wasn't as bad as I thought. It's a really cool stadium. It's really well set up. The noise really captures. Like, stuff like that. You're not getting. And so when he plays in KC, maybe KC's a unique one because they have a good home support and they've been around for a while and they've created that. But anyone who came to see Messi didn't see Sporting Park. They didn't experience the Blue Owl. They didn't experience what Sporting KC has that's unique. They experienced a high level sports event that is pretty much an NFL game.
I'm just not sure what you're supposed to do about that. Like, are you supposed to turn down 50,000 extra tickets and all of the money that comes from that to go and, like, try to help them experience what it's like at a normal? I don't know. I completely see where you're coming from, and I will concede it's not an ideal situation. Like, obviously, it would be better if all these teams were drawing 60K every single week and you were filling that regardless. Like, obviously, that's the ideal. In case folks didn't realize in the first two segments, we're not living in an ideal world when it comes to Major League Soccer. So I take your point, Gus. I don't know. Am I supposed to begrudge SKC for going and having 50K extra people? I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to.
So the question becomes, if San Jose hosts Messi and they do it at Santa Clara, anyone coming to that has no idea what a Quakes game is like. They don't know what the stadium's like. They don't know what the commute is like. They don't know what the tailgate's like. They don't know that experience. And you have not added that to what they do.
But were those people going to come anyway?
I don't know. But if you do and they come back, let's think long term. Yeah, you've given up whatever $1 million you're going to make on that game to hopefully sell 5,000 to 10,000 more tickets over the course of time. Joe, you started this show by mentioning the product on the field is not exactly the most sellable part. To me, the most sellable part is the in-stadium experience.
Absolutely.
And if you get your one big shot on the big stage in front of your market and you take away your top selling prospect, I think that's a lost opportunity and I think that's a mistake. So that's where I come from. Now, as an MLS fan, I love seeing it because I watch sporting games at Sporting Park.
Something different. Yeah.
Sure. Right. So Arrowhead's like so fun and we all get hyped up. And when Galaxy moved to the Rose Bowl for LAFC, it's awesome because it's like for us, it's unique because we watch the same thing over and over. Yeah. But that's the opposite of most of the people that are coming to these Messi games.
How are these supporters going to know that Jimmy Conrad's number has been retired?
Exactly. Has been well, retired. That they make frozen blue lemonade with alcohol in it.
It's interesting, Goss, because I think I misunderstood at first. I thought you were saying, like, you lose the atmosphere, you lose the supporters groups and stuff like that. And my assumption was, well, they still go to those games.
Yeah.
But I take your point now that, like, you don't have that same atmosphere. You don't have – it's not replicable. So if you do have a really good time and you do want to go see another game, it's a different experience. It might be an even better experience, would maybe be the positive way to spin it, is that, like, oh, wow, there's a whole supporters section with a whole supporters bar and a whole supporters – like
blue lemonade that's frozen has alcohol in it, etc.
Exactly.
Et
also, that Peter Vermees might come there after the game and scream at you potentially. So I hear what you're saying. It's an interesting one, but it is the dilemma of how do you turn down that match day revenue
for sure.
at the expense of maybe future revenue. It's interesting.
Which is where the Chicago's and Revs and Charlotte's and Atlanta's hit the gold mine of they just don't have a stadium, so they don't have to worry about it.
Joe, let's talk about some things that actually happened on the pitch. Let's talk about the Galaxy for a moment. I feel like you have been a champion of the Galaxy going back to maybe last year, and now it seems like it's paying off dividends this year.
Oh, man. Wow. This just feels good. This just feels so good. The look on David's face and all this. The Galaxy topped Vancouver 3-1 in Vancouver. Very quickly on the Caps, because I don't think we spent a lot of time on them.
Caps too.
I'm also high on Vancouver. We didn't learn a ton about them through the first stretch of the season. Now they've got that harder schedule we talked about last week, and it's not exactly going their way. The Galaxy get 3 goals. Joseph Painsil continues to be an absolute menace on the right wing for them. You got Gabriel Peck actually playing next to Painsil instead of playing on the opposite wing. It was a 3-2-5 in possession with either Peck or Painsil wide on the right and the other one in the half space. And it would rotate through, but you'd have Mickey Amane staying deeper on that side. All the pieces in the attack just seem to fit right now. I'm not actually all the way sold on Peck and Painsil playing next to each other. I'm not sure if that's going to be the best look going forward. But we've seen it a few times this year. This was the most deliberate, it seems to me, from Greg Vanney. We saw it for the longest in this game. But there's just so much talent in the attack. The thing that I feel like we are learning throughout each game for the Galaxy is not that the attack is good. It's not that the defense is bad. While both of those things are very true, they give up another goal on a set piece. They're tragic defensively, and there's another world where Vancouver get another goal out of this game and make it much closer than it turned out to be. We didn't learn all that stuff. That stuff has been obvious from basically the first game, and it continues to be obvious now. What I think we're learning about the Galaxy is that their attack, the gap between their attack and their defense, is wide enough that the level they're playing at and the results that they're getting are very, very close to sustainable, if not actually sustainable. It doesn't take a genius to look at this Galaxy team and say, oh man, their attack's pretty good. And then to look at their 75-year-old combined center backs and say, oh man, that defense is vulnerable. And their next best center back is a teenager in Jalen Neal. Like, it doesn't take a genius to figure that stuff out. But what I honestly think we're learning is that it might not matter how poor the defense is. Is it ideal? Absolutely not. Is it a season derailing problem for the Galaxy? Not so far. Like, they're on top of the Western Conference. I think it might be sustainable for them to continue to play like 3-1, 4-2, 3-2 kind of games and win a lot in route to maybe a trophy, maybe not. The best teams are still in the East. But that's the thing that I think I'm taking away from the Galaxy right now.
If we're taking things away from California teams, Gus, what have we learned so far about San Jose?
That you get what you pay for. And if you don't pay for goals, you don't get goals. Like, I have always stood on this soapbox, specifically with goal scoring, is like, you can see the correlation between money spent and goals scored. It's the fruit of the game, and like, guys who can't move and put it in the back of the net get paid the most money on every team. And San Jose refuses to spend money. So, like, you can complain about patterns of play, ideas, some of the starting form or some of the starting lineup stuff that Lucci's choosing. And you can lean on some of the players that they've brought in. But, like, in reality, if you're going in with less bullets in your chamber, this is what you get. And there's ways to fudge around this. Vancouver's kind of an example. But they've still spent some money on some good players in their prime who have come in and allow a Brian White to score goals and get chances. And in a system that works, San Jose has done none of that. And the pieces they've ended up landing on are all finishers, and they don't have a creator to help in any way with that. And those finishers now lack confidence because they don't get chances and they don't score goals. And it's just a downward trend from there. So I don't see how San Jose fixes this in the current setup they're in, no matter who's in charge.
Do you think Wiebe is trying to quietly sell some of that Amal Pellegrino stock that he purchased in the offseason?
Listen, this feels like one of those situations where in a year, Philly trades for him for like 50K after they've sold, I don't know, Ura Carranza or Quinn Sullivan or whatever, and he scores like 19 goals there.
Yep, that checks out and feels about right.
I also have purchased Amal Pellegrino stock, and I'm not quite ready to ditch it. So that's what I'm saying right now. The Quakes lose 3-0 to the Colorado Rapids over the weekend. They were not especially good. I mean, they created chances. Like, the Quakes created chances. Yeah. They're just not finishing at a high level. And for me, it's honestly less about the attack. I understand they lose this game 3-0. It's a little bit less about the attack and more about everything beneath that attacking trio. I don't mind the Obobese Espinosa, who is still one of the best wingers in the league, and Amal Pellegrino trio, but the midfield isn't particularly strong, and the back line still doesn't look strong, and the goalkeeping has been abysmal. They've had the worst goalkeeper in MLS this year. It's a really narrow penalty call on Yarborough for the first goal that Rafa Navarro scores in the penalty spot. It's a really, really narrow call. I'm not really sure if there's contact or not.
But he doesn't have to come off his line.
But he doesn't necessarily have to come off his line, and he doesn't execute in that moment anyway. So like, it's just another example of the Quakes struggling at the back end, and that has been a huge problem for them this year. They've created some chances, but they've not been able to keep teams locked down at the other end. So there are obvious problems, and I don't think it's wrong to highlight the attack, to be clear, but I'm just not quite ready to let go of that Pellegrino stock.
Nor am I.
Joe's just trying to drive up the price.
That makes sense.
Then I sell. Then I'm dumping.
I did the preview for San Jose. I was pretty hyped about them. I had to ask Joe before we started recording, why are people so down on them? Now I've started
for
to
the
see
reasons
why.
I just said. Is the answer to that?
But I mean, the big one for me was just that if they wanted to go with like a 4-2-3-1 shape, the number 10 in that one was a big old question mark with no real options. And we saw Securus Morales, you will start this weekend. There was some speculation that maybe that would be Securus as the 10. That has obviously not gone swimmingly. So still not a ton of clarity on who that will be or how they get out of this situation, which maybe has a coach on a hot seat in the form of Lucci. But I don't know if any triggers are getting pulled anytime soon.
I don't really understand exactly what Lucci's doing. I'm not entirely sure that he knows what kind of soccer he wants to play with this team. I know I'm the guy that beats the drum that managers aren't the most important thing. And that's true, right? If San Jose have the Galaxy's talent, like, it doesn't matter who's coaching them. They're going to be better than they are right now. What I will say is you look around MLS the last couple of years, and I think it's very clear to see with Nantes and Columbus. We're seeing it now with Laurent Courtois in Montreal. Like, Montreal is a better equivalent to San Jose, a team that doesn't have a ton of top-end talent, but you look at them, and players clearly know where to be. They know how to move the ball. They know how to move off the ball. And that eliminates the simple but very common mistakes that we see all the time around not just MLS but around the world of teams that are just poorly set up, where there's redundant spacing, players in the same spots, the ball doesn't move at the right tempo, there's not sharp off-ball movement, the press isn't coordinated. Almost all of those things that I just said apply to the Quakes. Like, I don't see, under Lucci right now, this overarching style. It feels like he's sort of caught between two minds of, and I'd love to hear from him, and maybe he has different opinions and like would clearly disagree. I'm sure he would. But I don't see them leaning really in one way or another, and I've talked about this with the Rapids. Like, if you don't lead one way or another, when you don't have a ton of top-end talent in your team, you're just sort of asking to be mediocre as your ceiling and probably going to end up being worse than that. And I just don't see where the Quakes are leaning right now, and I don't think we're looking at 11 players out on the field that are on the same page.
So we had Happy Joe talking about the Galaxy. Now we've got Concerned Joe talking about San Jose. Let's go back to Happy Joe. Joe, tell us about Montreal for a moment.
All right. I love Montreal. They're so fun to watch right now. I'm not actually sure how good they are, to be very clear, because Joe, they're missing top-end talent. But I'm happy because they're fun to watch, man. And as a neutral who watches way too much MLS, that is one thing that I really care about. And it's not just that Montreal are fun, although they are very much so. We saw 3-4-3 against Cincy in their first home game of the season, 2-1 win. And they're like moving the ball. They're building from the back. They had like 60% possession in this game prior to Cincy really having to buckle down and try to get back into this one in the second half, where it flipped a little bit the other direction. But man, this Montreal team, they are the picture of coordination right now. The players understand where to drop. They're doing all the things that I just said San Jose basically aren't doing right now. The problem is I just don't see the top end talent in this team. We have Kokoro and Yankov come in over the offseason. There's a couple other pieces in the back that come in. None of these guys are difference makers. The Crew are special, yes, because they have an overarching approach and they're more committed to it than any team in MLS. But they're also special because they have top-end talent. And Cucho Hernandez is an MVP-level player, and they have like three other guys who are better than any single player that Montreal have. So I don't think this Montreal team is all the way there. Man, I am real high on what Laurent Courtois has done with this group and how they seem to have a real identity that is helping fuel their results, and it certainly was the case over the weekend.
If we don't know that they're all the way there quite yet, Joe, would the same apply to FC Cincinnati, who were beaten by Montreal on the weekend?
Very much so. Goss, let me ask you a question. You can pick either one of these. How surprised are you that Corey Baird's been benched at this point in the year, and how concerned are you that Corey Baird has been benched for Yuya Kubo, which is now officially happening in Cincinnati right now? So either how surprised or how concerned are you about what's happening in the front line in Cincy?
I'm not surprised. So that would take that one off the board. Concern, I think, is a fair one and is high because one of the things that made Cincinnati great over the last few years, let's go back to the whole first 20 minutes of the show, was like they hit against the roster rules. Brandon Vasquez was a borderline DP level talent playing on like a borderline minimum contract for a large amount of time. I think Bupenza is better than Brenner and can bring more to the team, so they don't need to fill that whole role. But that's what they were trying to do with a Corey Baird, of like find a piece in the league that was going to help them more than it helped the teams he came from. Although in fairness, he had a good year in Houston. I didn't think it was a guarantee. I didn't think it would work. I kind of thought he would be in like a Sergio Santos rotation spot, everyone trying to find their feet. But it's still tough for Cincinnati because they don't have the financial flexibility to replace Vasquez like for like. They need to hit on something. So if it's Kubo resurrecting his attacking career from 4 years ago in Belgium when he came in as a DP winger, if it's Sergio Santos finding his feet finally and like becoming that, or if it's going and finding another piece, I think like a Daniel Rios would have made a ton of sense here. He's now on loan at Atlanta. They probably are going to go and try and fill this role again over the course of the summer. I think that was going to be necessary no matter what. I would have been more shocked, Joe, rather than him being benched, if Corey Baird scored 12 goals or more this year.
Joe, continuing to let you choose how you want to cover these teams, would you rather talk happily about St. Louis or would you rather have concerns about Austin?
I would rather talk happily about St. Louis, who took care of business. Like I talked about how we're learning a bit about the Galaxy. I don't really think we learned anything about St. Louis from this 1-0 win at home against Austin FC because of how bad, frankly, Austin are. Boom, doing both at the same time, Taylor, you can't stop me. Austin FC have played 3 road games this year. They've racked up less than 0.2 expected goals in each one of those road games. Shout out to Armand Kafai, who's doing good stuff for us at back. You'll find in that stat. Like, that is wild to me. They are absolutely abysmal, Austin, in the attack, on the road. They looked completely overawed against the St. Louis team that they've played before and have had problems against before, to be clear. But they were really, really terrible. And that's why I think it's a little bit difficult to learn too much about St. Louis. But this is still a nice performance from them. They were in control the entire time. They controlled the game defensively. The attack, the goal that they score is a nice sequence starting in their own half where they just knife right through Austin's lackadaisical defensive shape. It's a good result for St. Louis. It's not one that I think, you know, Bradley Carnell is going to point to as he looks to build this year. But 3 points against a team that's likely going to finish towards the bottom of the Western Conference, those are the kinds of performances you need as you go and try to follow up the excellent 2023 campaign that you had if you're St. Louis.
We are going a little bit long, so I will bring us to the final segment. I'm calling it the AOB section, which would be the any other business. Goss, any other business, any teams, individuals, players, coaches, managers, whatever you want to go with that we have not yet discussed?
I was going to just touch on, I think, for the Portland Timbers. 2-2, fine result. You get the red card early in the second half against you, so you're against it a little bit, and you're not going to go out and win at home. They started Felipe Mora. They played Jonathan Rodriguez kind of on the wing. When they're against the ball, Evander slides up and becomes the second forward. I still don't understand a world where Claudio Bravo and Juan David Mosquera are starters on a successful MLS team at both fullback positions. And if it was me, I would give up what I get from Bravo in the attack to slide Evander out wide, giving him the complete freedom and playing Rodriguez up top alongside Mora, if that's the setup that you go with, which is what they did in this game. Evander gets the freedom. He gets to find the game. He can be a goal scorer. He can be a winger, whatever, the same way he does. But it felt like Rodriguez was wasted a lot out wide rather than Mora as a pure in-the-box scorer, has a couple flicks and touches around him if the players are close enough to him. And I think Rodriguez can help out there. I think there's a limitation on who Portland can be with the collection of players we see them starting week in and week out, both at the center back position and at that fullback position. But I think it's actually fixable in their roster if Phil Neville chooses to make some tougher decisions of like not starting the 11 highest paid players on the roster.
I like the Rodriguez on the left and Felipe Mora through the middle, mostly because I think Felipe Mora is a really good MLS number 9. He just can't stay healthy. And if he can stay healthy, I like the idea of having those two play off of each other. There's a nice bit of interplay between those two, like 2 minutes into the game against LAFC, 2-2 yeah. Draw. Not a great result for the Timbers. But man, like they seem to understand each other. And Rodriguez's movement is just so good. Like his understanding of space. We saw it when he played as the 9 in his first game. I think that was against Philly, where he's just popping up in the box in so many good spots. And you do lose some of that when you push him a little bit wider, but he's not playing as like a dribbly left winger. He's almost more of a, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a target sort of winger like Mario Mandzukic would do at times in the past and in different points of his career. He's not quite as big and he's not quite as influential when the ball's in the air coming his way, but that's the picture I'm trying to paint, right? He's like, he's there for his off-ball movement. He's there to be the secondary scorer. And I think a Felipe Mora, Jonathan Rodriguez 1-2 punch is good. Gosh, so I take your point about some of the general structure of this Timbers team. I don't think they figured out how to exist when Juan Mosquera is on the field, frankly. He's incredibly gifted in the attack. His defensive work is a liability for the most part. So I don't think the puzzle is finished in Portland, especially because I think they probably want to add one more really high-level DP because that's what they're talking about doing and bragging about, and they haven't done it yet, as good as I think Jonathan Rodriguez is. But I'm actually cautiously optimistic about some of the attacking setup. It's the defensive stuff that concerns me.
Joe just annexing all of David Goss's any other business section. I see how it is, Joe. Joe, since you have powered your way in, any other business from you before we call this one quits?
Nah, that's good. That's good for me. Yeah. I'm happy I've annexed.
Casually sipping water, waiting to smoke his multiple vapes at once. If there were one person in the world who I was confident had never vaped in his life, it's Joe Lowry.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Sorry, I don't like that breathing in like a weird fruit-flavored colored clouds.
I never have either, and
I
never
will.
Am I
supposed to apologize for that? I'm not sure.
You are not. You are not. David Goss, however, the consummate vaping professional, competitive vapor, I believe.
No, dude, I'm old school, baby. I walk around with the full hookah. I literally walk around with a full 6-foot hookah alongside me. I got a little carrying case and everything.
That was so specific. I feel like that's maybe been a thing that happened. I feel like you are a hookah guy. Are you a hookah guy?
No, but in the right spots.
All right. All right. Well, David Goss, thank you for your hookah knowledge and your MLS knowledge. It is always appreciated. We will not have you next week. So I guess I'll thank you again for this one.
Chag Sameach, everyone, in advance. Happy Tyler Adams to you.
Happy Tyler Adams to you. Joe Lowry, happy Tyler Adams to you.
And to you, sir.
Listeners, thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for supporting the show, as always. And we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.